गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। वेलकम, प्रणाम टू ईच वन ऑफ यू। ग्रीटिंग्स फ्रॉम इंग्लैंड। Just arrived a few hours ago, driving from Wales, and about to start our UK retreat in a few hours, actually. So, but happy to have the time to make this arrangement a little earlier than usual for us to still meet and not lose 2 weeks in a row without meeting in our English satsang. So happy to be here. Maybe today's gathering may be a little shorter than usually, so we have time to prepare for the next lecture that I have introducing the retreat here with the devotees that are arriving now. But still, blessed and grateful to be here today with all of you. So, welcome to our space for sharing and exchanging and nourishing and witnessing and trying to, learn to listen, learn to access reality and the truth the most open, free, and pure and free way possible. It's an ongoing project, so we all need grace, we all need support and help. So here we are, praying to show up in the most authentic way possible. So we invite you, as usual, if you have any questions, any thoughts, any doubts, any themes you would like to explore, to set us on a quest together, exploring endless reality from whatever angle it begs to be explored, for us to honor it properly. You can raise your digital hand, whatever offering you have to present today. And I see so far three raised hands from Bhakta Prem, Rasangi, and Katie. So we'll start there. And as you can see, we are a little bit less than usual because almost half of the people who always connect is here with us, actually, in the UK. So we have them arriving and accommodating and all that stuff of day one of a retreat, right? So we'll start with Bhakta Prem. Bhakta Prem, welcome. You can unmute yourself and present your question to us.
Actually, it was Rasangi who. I'll go first. Anyway,
Yeah, we'll have time for everyone.
I have a really silly question, like always in my mind. And like Krishna is in Goloka Vrindavan with all his Nitya Parisav forever and ever. So, how it works when new members come to the spiritual world, like Lalita's group is full, all the services are full, I think. So many new pure souls go to Vrindavan. I think how the service work there. I think this question maybe I will answer when I get samadhi someday in some life. It's not like it's like a how question. It's not easy to understand that. So this is quite a silly question, but if you want to explore something about, so help me out. Thank you.
No, thank you. Yeah, of course, in one sense, thank you for the question. In one sense, the answer will be the question is not fully answerable till you get there. And we can say some things, of course, and we should, but at the end of the day, the final answer, quote unquote, final is by arrival, right? By arrival, by direct experience. It's like, I don't know, even without going to Golok Vrindavan, right? Even if you ask me, okay, Swami, you've been in Switzerland. What does the last few weeks, what's Switzerland about? How does it feel? Or, and I can start trying to describe you. This is like that. I can even show you pictures. I can send you some links for videos, but it's never the same as you traveling and being in Switzerland or any other place. Just I'm giving an example. So the ultimate experience is through arrival, right? So even if that happens here, what to speak of the land, the unlimited land of unlimited love? How much less can we understand that without being there? So that's one thing. But of course, what we can say is, I just say that first to humble our situation, our stance, and try to understand that there is so much that we can figure. There's only that much that we can figure out on this side of the equation. And even on that side of the equation, in one sense, now nobody's trying to figure that out. Nobody's trying to overexplain things, and things happen by participation, but full participation. So the question concerns a little bit more. The main question has to do, from what I heard, from what I understood, it's concerned with themes of space, right? Space, numbers, people in groups, and newcomers, so to say, new arrivals, how to host the new guests. They're not guests, of course, pilgrims forever. But again, we are talking about the land that is beyond our usual experience of time and space. There is a type of space, there is a type of time, there are forms, there are all these ingredients that we experience here. But at the same time, we have been cautioned many times to be very careful not to fully project our experience of form, time, and space here over there. That's why in the first verse of the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, material creation is likened to an inverted banyan tree, which basically is like the idea is of a reflection, right? If you see a tree reflected into a lake, it's basically the same tree to some degree, but it's upside down, right? So, in other words, the idea is whatever we find here, it's a hint that all the things exist over there, but at the same time, still is a reflection. Not to say that this is not true, just saying that in comparison to how things operate there, our notion of form here, which is subject to time and decay and all the things we know, is a hint to a particular form in eternity that does not undergo those types of chapters, decay, sickness, death. So the same with time and space, no? That here we may find them sometimes limiting, sometimes suffocating, but there are hints to what's eternal time, to what's ever expanding space in the spiritual world. So there is time, there is space, there is form in Golok Vrindavan, in Vaikuntha. And I would say the very name Vaikuntha already, in one sense, answers your question, because Vaikuntha means without limits. So if you are entering a place that bears such a name, it indicates there are no limits here. So there's not a limited space, even though it sounds like that to our ears over here when we hear the descriptions of Vrindavan and the Leelas, and it all sounds limited. It sounds even ordinary if we don't have the the proper ears to hear, it may sound like mundane. So we need to gradually train our ears. Srutekshita, the Bhagavatam would say, Sruta Ikshita. We must learn to see through hearing, to train our way of listening, Harikatha, explanations of revelation. So that transforms into a type of Ikshita, into a type of seeing, into a type of vision. And it's not just like calculation. So in Vaikuntha there is unlimited space, so it will never run out of space. It's not like it will ever get crowded. And again, I know it's difficult for us to think about it, because still we will think with our point of reference here. Now, if new people come, millions of people come, it will get too crowded. Where will the intimacy of the Leelas in Vrindavan remain? It will be a multitude. It will be a mainstream wave of people, and how the peace and the of the rural setting in Vrindavan will be totally disturbed, and it will become more like a football stadium or something. And we want just that intimate service in the forest of Rasa. We may have our concerns. Shall I go there? Will Vrindavan in Golok become as crowded as Vrindavan on planet Earth? Because nowadays you go to Vrindavan and it's pretty crowded, right? It's a little common, it's a little challenging to experience the intimacy of that land on its outer carcass, its outer form, but still the essence remains there. If we can contact that, besides the form, besides the noise, besides the pollution, besides the crowd, besides whatever may challenge our perception. That's why we need to go beyond our current perception by hearing, by practicing, by preparing our hearts to enter that language. It's all accommodating, it's all expansive. Srila Prabhupada gave this nice example once when one devotee was asking him again, a little bit trying to understand the dynamics of the eternal lila from the point of view of local miles and kilometers and distance and time and space. And he asked, well, I'm studying Krishna's daily activities in the spiritual world, and I'm hearing that he's going from this place to this place to that place, Govardhan, Barsan, Radha. And I'm making the calculations of how the distance between places and how much it takes walking from one place to another, and it doesn't make sense. The math doesn't work. How Krishna can go from one place to another in that amount of time? Well, to begin with, Krishna's God, right? So he can be pretty speedy. But on top of that, Prabhupada gave this example about how the land itself, in this case Vrindavan, can expand or contract accordingly to facilitate the movements of the lila. He gave the example of the lotus flower. He says Vrindavan is like a lotus. So all this place, he opened his hand and each finger was kind of one petal of the lotus, and each petal is kind of one place there. So they seem far to one another, distant from one another. He said, when the necessity comes for one place to become nearer for Krishna to be able to get there, so he said the lotus closes and all the petals remain one next to each other, so you can move from one to the other. It was funny because he could have said, no, Krishna is God and he can reach those places quickly, but he went to a more Jogamaya-like explanation, like which keeps the apparent ordinariness and simplicity of the lila. Now the lotus just contracts and Krishna can jump from one petal to the other and then the lotus opens again. He didn't need to say Krishna is God. He can do that. And also again, it's important to understand that when we speak about, and I don't want to become too technical, but I may have to some degree, but the point, Vaikuntha priti vyadi sakala chinmaya, Chaitanya Charitamrita says, from Vaikuntha upward, Vaikuntha prithivi, the earth, the soil, sakala chinmaya, and everything else, just starting with the soil, which may sound the most insignificant thing, everything is chinmaya, everything is transcendental conscious substance. So it's not just what we think it is. It's not just earth, it's not just space. It's all made of Krishna's internal energy, specifically his ambit shakti. I mean, all his shaktis, Sandini Shakti, Sambit Shakti, Ladini Shakti, all these elements that comprise Swarup Shakti are what allow the spiritual world to exist. No? Sandini, the existential potency in spiritual terms, in bhakti terms. Sambit, the cognizance potency, and Ladini, the bliss potency. So the Vrindavan is made of Sandini Shakti. No? So it's not made of what we think, again, of earth, wood and walls and concrete and this meter and that mile and this size and this space is made of Swarup Shakti, of bhakti. It's made of love. So love's nature is ever expanding. Therefore, a land made of love is ever expanding and therefore can accommodate the ever expanding number of new members, so to say, entering into the land. And again, it's difficult to imagine. We may try to over and over resort to, but how that can possibly work, how that can happen. And then the load is on us. I'm trying to release the tendency to calculate that. Because if not, as the Vedanta Sutra say, Tarko Pratishthana, through logic alone, you get nowhere. You know? Especially when it comes to trying to understand eternity, infinity, logic leaves you in a limbo, basically. I'm not saying logic doesn't work in any department for anything, but when we are trying to understand some of these things, we need to resort more to a transrational, trans-empirical methodology. That's what sadhana is, rather than just trying to figure that out in our minds, which will be another attempt to measure the immeasurable, which is a contradiction in terms, it's an impossibility. So that will be another way to explain it. Spiritual realm is a land made of flops. Srila Siddhar Maharaj will refer to Vrindavan as, or to the different spiritual planets as planets of faith. Well, that's another way to speak. Planets of bhakti, planets of love, planets of faith. And as faith is ever evolving, ever expanding, ever accommodating, a heart with deep faith can accommodate what a heart without such deep faith cannot accommodate. So the land of full faith is fully accommodating. So there is space and place for everyone and everything. So yeah, it can expand accordingly, and when it contracts just in ways to facilitate expansion. As the example Prabhupada gave of the lotus closing, you could say it's contracting, but it's a contraction to allow Krishna to move closer to other places. So it's to facilitate love. It's in the service of the expansion of love. So even when we speak in terms of contraction of the spirit in that realm, it's just for the purpose of expansion of love. That's the nature of love. As I like to say, as I wrote in Evolution and Divine Love, there's no opposite to love because love can only become more of what it is. That's kind of the relentless, unstoppable pace of love. It's always in growing and expanding and becoming more of what it already is. And yeah, one aspect of that is new recruits, so to say, or newcomers arrive to the spiritual realm, and the land expands accordingly to accommodate that, no? And they th those newcomers, if we want to use the terminology, also are units of ever expanding love. So they themselves are, the very presence is facilitating expansion. It's not like, oh, there comes a newcomer, a burden to our land, we need to expand and accommodate. No, they themselves create the expansiveness and accommodation. And there are so many things that we can say, but in that connection, that again, going back to my first point, we will fully understand that by arrival, because it's also described that whomever arrives there feels like they have been there forever also. No, it's not so much like, okay, I just came yesterday, right? So what do I need, what do I do here, how I'm getting introduced to this land, to these people? That's why we always say it's not that I just practice mechanically, in one way superficially, my sadhana, and at the end of this life I've sent to Golok Vrindavan without having a clue what's going on there, who is there, what's the mood there, and then I need a whole guided tour to the land and a whole introduction about what's going on here, and I will be assigned a place to do and how to serve, and I need a whole full training when I'm there already. No, it doesn't happen like that. All those things, all that familiarity, getting familiar with that, getting imbibed with the essence of that land, happens before the official arrivals. And that's why when someone arrives there, if we want to use that term, again, we're talking in terms of time and distance, it feels like you've been there always. No? So it's very paradoxically, subjectively paradoxical. So it feels like home. That's why sometimes we use this expression back home, which doesn't mean you have been there, doesn't mean you have been there necessarily, but you have that subjective experience. This is home, I've always been there, even if you're a newcomer. Also to say, like, I don't know, like Sanatana Goswami depicts Gopa Kumara arrival to Vrindavan as an example, and it all feels very natural. But yeah, those will be some thoughts in terms of how to think, as much as, again, how to think about these things as much as we can think about those things, as much as those things are thinkable, we can, yeah, employ our faculties as much as we can, and then know when to put them to rest and allow experience to make the rest, and trust that the closer we get there, that's the arrival I'm referring to. It's not just one official moment, okay, I'm there, but gradually the closer we get to that realm, which is a state of consciousness, as I always like to remind, a spiritual world is not just a planet and geographically, geometrically measurable. It's a planet of love. It's a planet of consciousness. So it's only we can only arrive there or get closer to that as much as our consciousness aligns voluntarily to with that reality, with that dimension. So it's not just I was not there and now I'm there. It's a gradual alignment to that particular frequency of existence. And yeah, we can speak in terms of planets and forms and time and space, but it's all spiritual, it's all transcendental, it's all bhakti-like, it's all love-like. So in one sense, it's categorically different to our experience so far. So that's why it's important, and this may be the hardest part of all, to relinquish all our assumptions and all our ways of seeing things and trust and be open to a new way of perceiving things and understanding things. That's many times what gets most in the way. Not so much, okay, I will get this new information about the bring down or this or that, but then to get rid of certain ideas and assumptions and filters that prevent from our actual experience of what that's truly about. So it's a simultaneous work. Now we are Shravana Kirtan Vishnu. We are receiving this katha, this information, this revelation from Shastra, from sadhus, becoming inspired, hopefully becoming fascinated, becoming charmed and called and invited. And simultaneously, while all this content is coming, we may need to simultaneously work on detecting the filters and presumptions and prejudice and fears that get in the way of our genuine contact with that, and not starting to take that for granted and understand that in who knows which way, in how we understand other things. So it's an ongoing simultaneous process that we call sadhana bhakti. And we need to have all the elements in the same place. It's not just receiving the fascinating content and that's it, because I may be still filtering and projecting that with my old patterns, but it's not just working on old patterns without receiving new content, new revelation, new fascination. So okay, I hope that helps, Bhaktapram.
Yes, Maharaj, it helps a lot. I
Okay.
knew my question was quite silly, but I
Oh.
knew your answer will be fulfill my heart, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And there are no silly questions. As basic or simple as they may sound, we always trust that something important can come if they are brought from a sincere place. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Maharaj.
You. Okay. So before moving to the next quest, exploration, theme, maybe we can, since we won't have many today, probably we'll spend some time also in our breakout rooms, inviting each one of you some more private moments to share with one another and turn together a little bit more of these thoughts that we have just shared in Sangha, in friendship, in trust, in openness. See you back in a few minutes. Welcome back. Hoping you had some few minutes, nice few minutes of churning. Sivatan says even a few minutes are enough to attain all perfection. So let's not underestimate our breakout rooms. No? Sometimes you can go in a breakout room and never return from it because perfection has been attained. So if in case we miss someone from our return, we know what happened. It became a breakthrough room. Yeah, let's speaking about time and space, let's take time and space seriously, and a few minutes of sharing or even solitary contemplation, ruminating on those truths can deeply change our trajectory. Speaking of which, we'll continue, hopefully, to honor time properly and invite, in this case, Rasangi or whatever is there to be shared from that side today. So welcome.
Yes, thank you, Maharaj. And it feels like, I mean, I wanted to say that Sajjan had some profound realizations from your last answer, the question and answer. Just it was very uplifting and delightful. So just to say that, because you sometimes ask for feedback from the breakout rooms, I'll just
Thank
say that, that was uplifting for us
you. I
because he
forgot
was so
to ask.
uplifted. Oh, he was so, it was like, like a big realization for him already. Anyway, and we were talking about, because when we come in touch with the current, we feel it. Bhakta Prem was so thrilled by the answer and felt the touch of divinity when it comes through us. As we allow it, we get to inspire each other. So that's very cool. Anyway, my question is about spiritual imperfectionism. Yes, spiritual imperfectionism, Maharaj, and you mentioned it before as perhaps one of the blocks to us understanding the higher truths more clearly, or seeing things more clearly. And Bhakta Ras also mentioned that in her little comment. So we're studying this yesterday, and just by doing the pauses, the ninth pause, reflecting and discussing, more questions come, and more a need for expansion on things, okay? So that's what I'm talking about today, I'm asking about. So we, from this section, understanding that the word mistake is like weaponized and loaded, and it has a stigma of shame and wrong to it, right? The word mistake. But like you so beautifully shifted it in this section to a different a framework, seeing mistakes not as like shame-based and you're damned or you're wrong, but seeing mistakes as an opportunity for expansion. And I think that's going to take some time for all of us to, for me to really accommodate that and feel comfortable with my errors of judgment or seeming mistakes, because I still get really self down on myself when I make mistakes, And from what I'm reading, that's not necessary, and that we can shift that and be more open and kind and loving to ourselves, even amidst seeming big mistakes, so to speak, that we may make. So the second part of it is that it seems like in order to fulfill our role here, we have to follow our inner guidance, which is scary because of making mistakes. But then if we don't do that, we're going to stay small. We're not going to grow. Do you understand my question?
No.
No? Okay.
Haven't heard any questions so far from my perspective.
Oh, I went. No, but do you understand what I said, though? Oh, good. All right. So I'd like you to speak about, talk a little bit about more how to face our errors with a more gentle approach, not as self-condemning, being kind to ourselves. And I think that's part of our expansion into understanding higher truths, is that we can do that. Is that true? Do you feel like that is valid? That I'm able to not beat up myself when I make a mistake, that I'm able to be kind and look at it as an opportunity for expansion, that in itself is an opportunity for me to grow into love, into more love, into feeling loved. I hope that makes sense. It makes sense to me.
Okay,
It's coming. Yeah, go
I'll
ahead.
share words. Of course, thank you for the invitation. And of course, big part of what I may have to say is it has been written in that section of the book, Spiritual Perfectionism, because I think it's As you say, it's an important idea to explore what's a mistake to begin with, right? Because sometimes we use the word mistake, we do a mistake, we do a mistake, and in one sense, I mean, we're always doing mistakes, right? Mistakes is not, sometimes we think mistake is something that we have to avoid at all costs, and only then what I'm doing has any meaning, has any value, has any, has count, counts in terms of my relationship with God. But if there is a mistake, the whole subject is spoiled, so to say, huh? And that's too extreme, right? That's too much. And Christian himself, as I think, or as I hope, I included in that section of the chapter, I think I did it, that Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, every action is accompanied by some form of imperfection. So there you have it. There you have the de-neurotizing statement in the Bhagavad Gita. It's not that Krishna is endorsing and promoting be as imperfect as you can. Of course, we are not here doing like doing a campaign for hyper imperfection, but just making a very realistic assessment of the field, which is there's always some faults. There are always some fault in any single action. And he even is talking in that context of great people and wise people. It's not just speaking about the super conditioned souls, no? But there, of course, the point is then there are mistakes and mistakes. So there are some mis which are the mistakes that are avoidable easily, and still we are not avoiding them. Which are those things that we know we can, how to say, we shouldn't, we don't need to surrender to, but we still surrender to. So the true mistake is not so much not being perfect in every way, because that's not possible. So if you start with the foundation of impossibility, that makes for a very neurotic life, right? If the preliminary foundation is be perfect, which again, we talked about this many times, it's very contradictory and very absurd, but many times we do that. We force or demand that we are perfect first to begin our practice. It's like, it's an absolute nonsense, right? It's like if I'm going to a guitar class and I expect to be a self-realized guitar player before going taking the first guitar class, it's like I'm having the whole back math backwards. So that's why Krishna the Gita say there is some amount of imperfection in every action, not even in some action, in every action. In every action, we could say we are to some degree falling short of the infinite. Because remember, we are facing the infinite here. So what's perfection in our approach to something infinite? There's always some lacking, there's always some falling short, there's always something that can be improved and that will be improved and that will be expanded, but there's no end to that expansion either. So in that sense, if we want to label all that as imperfection, then there will be imperfection forever. No? If we want to say there is room for improvement in eternity, and if you want to translate room for improvement as imperfection, okay, there will be imperfection for eternity. But the problem is not so much with the word imperfection, I will argue, as I tried to argue in the chapter. The main problem is with the word perfection. No. With the word perfection, because for many of us, perfection means this fixed maximum, this rooftop, this dead end where you do everything perfect and there's no more room for improvement, which again is a very imperfect definition of perfection,
Or
right?
flawless, to be flawless.
Yeah, but one side you can say what's flawless to begin with, and I will argue if you are sincere, as sincere as you can in this present moment, that's flawless. It's not about some other minor mistakes that may be always around. But on top of that, again, we are not here so much concerned about something being flawless, but we are more concerned about about there being eternal room for infinite growth. So even if I'm flawless, hypothetically, which I'm not, so that's why I say hypothetically, even if I do this one thing flawlessly, whatever that may be, I will offer this prasad in the altar flawlessly. I will prepare this garland flawlessly. And generally, we have very external ideas about what that means, right? It's on the outlook. Oh, that garland looks flawless. Yeah, but where was your mind and heart while doing that? Or where's your mind and heart now that people is telling you that your garland is flawless? So for me, the main thing is not so much let's be flawless, because that's still something defined in negative terms. But let's make it as positive as possible. So when we speak in terms of positive development and offering our hearts and giving ourselves, there's ongoing room for improvement. There's no end to the growth. So it can always get better. But many times when we say flawless, in a very subtle way, generally, we implies it cannot get better than that. It's flawless. It's perfect. It's impeccable. So we've hit a rooftop. We have hit a dead end. We've made flawless performance or whatever, a fixed maximum. It cannot get better. And that in itself is a flaw. That in itself is one of the biggest imperfections. True imperfections means conceiving perfection in such a way. Because again, when we understand the nature of perfection, you understand it's always getting better. Like the song of the Beatles, it's getting better all the time. So if it's getting better all the time, will you consider the previous version of getting better imperfect and the new updated version perfect? No, it's what was perfect all the time, and it keeps getting more and more perfect, and there's no end to that perfection. So may need to redefine perfection, as I try to do in the chapter, so then we can deal with imperfection in a more healthy way. Because many times the toxic ways we've dealt with the notion of imperfection indirectly speak of how toxically we are dealing with perfection itself. Because again, imperfection, you can only define imperfection in the light of perfection, right? When you like condemn something as imperfect, with you stigmatize or criticize this imperfect in you or others, it's with an idea in your mind of what's perfect, and whatever doesn't fit into that idea, then that's imperfect. But to begin with, our ideas of perfection are wrong. So then the ideas of imperfection that are an indirect comparison to that perfection are equally wrong, two sides of the same coin. So yeah, we may need to sit for some time and rediscover both perfection and imperfection. And in that sense, then both can become more spacious, ever new, open doors for perpetual learning. And imperfection now becomes real. Imperfection means not conceiving perfection properly, and therefore not conceiving imperfection properly, limiting all the things. But because many times that's how we deal with perfection and imperfection, right? Perfection is this fixed maximum, this dead end, and imperfection is you did it wrong, you are bad. It's all of that is very reductionistic, very small, very suffocating ways of defining both perfection and imperfection. Now, if I say perfection is an ongoing expansion of perpetual learning, that's nice. And interestingly enough, when you define perfection in that way, you kind of are in a place to define imperfection almost in the same way. No? Because if perfection is an ongoing opportunity for expansion and growth, and you can actually define imperfection the same way. So at that point, what's the difference between perfection and imperfection? In one sense, those two categories collapse. Those two like oppositional words kind of become one. Because if through any mistake I made, whatever you could think of mistake, I'm sincere enough and I can learn from that and grow, how much can I call that mistake or imperfection? So for me, that's what when I said, yeah, the true only imperfection is the unwillingness to learn, the unwillingness to see everything as a lesson. That's what prevents me to make imperfection perfect, so to say. Or another way I mean, we can speak of this from so many ways or angles, but true perfection, as Father Richard Rohr will beautifully say, true perfection is not the exclusion of imperfection. True perfection is the inclusion of imperfection. If something is genuinely perfect, it has the capacity to include imperfection in its embrace, not to exclude it, not to ostracize it, not to whatever, right? Stigmatize it. True perfection is broad enough, deep enough, loving enough, perfect enough to give space to imperfection. So imperfection can find its place and from there grow, mature, get nourished, change, transmute, transform, and become more and more perfect. But again, it's an ongoing journey of further refinement that never ends, and in one sense, that has never begun. So, how much can we label? Oh, this is imperfection, and now this is perfection. If there is this openness to grow, everything is part of that refining journey. And so, I think then just to boil it down to one point is. Our main concern or our main responsibility is try to check within ourselves our willingness to grow and remain open to change. Because if not, that's when we start to the judging, we activate the judging pattern. Generally starting with ourselves, but then projecting that onto others. Generally, if we are very judgmental of other people, that speaks about how judgmental we are with ourselves, basically. There's not much way around that. So when we keep labeling people and putting people into boxes and you did that and you're imperfect, it all speaks how much we are throwing that at ourselves. So the healing always begins at home. And yeah, I think there is a place to, there's an ideal point of proper merging, where perfection and imperfection, as I say before, both can be defined in the exact same terms, like an ongoing journey of further growth, further refinement. So we don't need anymore to use these oppositional definitions. During some time, they are necessary, that's okay. But at one point, it's just one thing, right? So, yeah, I don't know if some of the things I shared address what you
Well, that was
think.
awesome as usual. But the thing is that, I mean, I love that. Thank you so much. That loosens the grip a little more of this stigma. And yet there's another part of it, like what you say in radical personalism. This is what I'm trying to get at too, is that if there's time, I think perhaps a little bit more. But that like Jordan Peterson said, to believe in God doesn't mean to state it, but to fully act out what you believe in. So some of the fear comes from acting out and believing in myself enough to put it out there. But then if we're in a safe environment where there's unconditional kind of love, we grow from our mistakes. So that's the gift of the Sangha, of what we have. And to stay small, we stay bonsai, to not speak up, not speak our truth or share who we are. We stay small and don't expand as much as if we're willing to risk speaking and being wrong and learning from it. Anything to say about that?
Yeah, a lot to say, but we have other hands raised, and I would like also to. I think I shared enough regarding your question, and it's an ongoing question, and we could continue.
Oh yeah, I would love to do that sometime. Absolutely. It's like, yeah. So.
Again, I don't want to sound repetitive, but my books are attempts to say something about that.
Yeah. That's
Always,
what I'm getting it from.
we can always say more about that perpetually, and that's our celebration, right? That's why we get together every weekend, and we don't get tired, hopefully, of sharing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another time.
You for that reflection. We
Yeah.
have eternity on our side. Okay, we have two more raised hands I'm seeing, but before that, we'll go one more time to the breakout rooms for a few moments to discuss about this important theme of imperfection, perfection, redefining these terms, how we deal with them, how we integrate them, how the two can become one, ideally, whatever has resonated with you the most. We invite you to for a few minutes of reflection, collective or personal, if you need your personal time. Remembering, in a few minutes, everything can happen. Breakout can become breakthrough, maybe with some breakdown in between. And see you soon. Yeah, we'll go there and see you back in a few minutes. Welcome. Welcome you all back. Hoping you have some enriching time together. And we have two more raised hands that we will try to honor, considering our available time. So sorry if it's not as generous as time say we'll like to offer to you today, but we'll want to offer to honor those two hands. The first one raised originally was from Katie, and then we have Silpa Karini. So I invite Katie to unmute herself, and then we'll go to Silpa Karini to conclude today's meeting. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Maharaj. Mine is not super important. I just was rereading the Mahabharata recently, and I got to the end when all of Krishna's direct associates leave the planet because they became intoxicated and they all fought amongst each other and killed each other. And I've read that before, but this time I was hit by that and I just thought to myself, this feels like an odd way for Krishna to have arranged for his family to leave the planet and for Krishna himself to leave the planet by getting hit by an arrow. And I mean, to me, the way that Lord Balaram left seemed more spiritual, or however, he went to the seashore and Anantaseish manifested and all of that. And I'm like, why didn't they all just poof disappear like in a cloud of sparkles and unicorns? And the violence and the intoxication part just kind of caught me off guard. And I've probably listened to thousands of classes over, the decades, and I can't remember ever hearing anything about this pastime, like why everybody left the way they did. And I don't know, not a super important topic, but it just stuck in my mind, and I was curious if you had any thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. Katie has opened a can of worms now. That's a big topic in many ways, of course, as you say. At the same time, it's not for us the most like important or even relishable lila, so to say. And you may have not have heard many times Gaudiya Vaishnava discussing it. Because again, in comparison to other leelas, they are not that important in the sense that, of course, they're wrapping up of certain pastime on earth, but from figures that remain, come, remain, and go to eternity. So say remain in, go, come from, go to. So it takes a particular external form, but actually, in one sense, they are untouched by whatever is going on the outside. If we are thinking of whether of Krishna is killed by the hunter, or of his eternal associates as being as even killing each other, basically, which I can understand is quite can sound a little bit quite intense. Those are certain associates, of course, with the gopis and the Brajavasis. We will receive a different depiction given in the Padma Purana and quoted in the Goswamis, which will be more akin to your taste, Katie. Some kind of a more mystical in manifestation. And there are a few things to say, and there are a few things that our Gaudiya Vaishnav say, because this Leela is also briefly mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the commentators speak there. And something to begin with to say is that certain Leelas, as they are describing the Mahabharata, they are not exactly described in the same way in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Like, for example, I mean, just and the point with this is that the two books are mostly addressed toward two different audiences, so they will emphasize different elements. For example, when the Pandavas are leaving, and you may have gone through that section also, that they are walking up the Himalayas, and anyhow, they are tested, and some disappear, and this and that. Eventually, they say they attain the heavenly planets, Swargalok, which could be a little bit strange for us, like the Pandavas attaining Swargalok, their eternal associates of Bhagavan in the spiritual world. But the main point is that the Mahabharata, in general, is spoken for people who are more interested in Dharma, art, and Kama, not so much moksha and what to speak prem. So from that perspective, it will emphasize certain attainments, not so much because the Pandavas attained that, but because most of the readers want to attain that. So it's a way of encouraging what they are looking for, supporting their faith. Now, if you read the Srimad Bhagavatam, and when the Bhagavatam describes the same Leela, say they attain the spiritual world. So again, it could seem like a contradiction of terms. Why this book say they went to Swarga, this book says they went beyond that. But in this particular case, it's because each one of these books is pointing to different audiences. I'm seeing the Chandrika is commenting regarding different versions of Mahaprabhu's passing. This will be slightly different, and I don't want to digress fully on the topic because, yeah, the main version is Mahaprabhu entering to Uttara Gopinath, but also there are a few other versions that he entered into Jagannath or he merged into the ocean. And in this case, once someone asked Śrīla-Siddhārtha Mahārāja which one of the three is the true one, and he said all of them. It's possible. Not doesn't mean that any and every theory will be true, but if he say it's possible for Bhagavan to pass from this world in more than one way, in the same way that what he and he quoted this verse from the Bhagavad and Malanam Asaninan Srinam Baru Srinam. Okay, one word is not coming, but this famous verse in the Bhagavad where Krishna's entering the arena of Kamsa. And different people are contemplating him from different perspectives. For one, Krishna is Cupid personified, for Kamsa is death personified, for his friends, he's his friend, their friend. And it's the same Krishna, but he's being seen differently. And each one of the subjective perceptions are equally true. Right? So, in the same way, he will say, Bhagavan can, again, going back to the first question of Bhakta Prem, it's not just, okay, there's only one way in which that happened. So we could say the Mahabharata could have rendered the disappearance Leela. And I'm not saying this is only the Mahabharata, because to be fair, in this case, Bhagavatam also mentions about the conflict between the Kurus at the end and the hunter. But we could make the case that also Bhagavan and his associates can close their Leela on earth in more than one way. And scriptures can depict one of those options, but that's not necessarily the only one. So that's one way to answer that. It's not limited to the version we know. It may have been one particular perception, as we gave the example of not only Mahaprabhu, but other Leelas. But even if we want to say, okay, that's the only way, the only possible version, that's the only way they left the world. And it sounds quite awkward. It sounds quite like negative, devastating, killing each other, and Krishna killed by an arrow shot in his foot sole. Was not there any other more like fancy mystical way to to disclose the lila? And for me, a simple answer to that will be the lila has not to obey our wishes, basically. Right? Like we may think, oh, that will be a better way, but the point is, who says that the lila has to adjust to how we like it to be? You know, ideally it's the other way around in one sense. Although, as we say, that realm is all accommodating, that doesn't mean that, I mean, it's all accommodating in the context of love. So sometimes we will find some leaders which are a little bit complex and difficult to understand, or that we will like them to be different, or we thought, oh, it would have been more, I don't know, romantic closing in this way, or more spiritual, or more mystical, or more whatever. But still, it's our personal wish, which I don't want to insult or downplay, but just also to say the world of Lila doesn't need to necessarily align with how we think things should happen in the ideal way. Because for that matter, many people will could make the same case with the totality of Krishna Lila. I mean, why God is a womanizer? Of course, there are ways to explain that. No, I'm not saying that in an ordinary way. Or why this is the, I will like it to be, I will like, and of course, there are many lilas and many facets of the divine that exist according to different tastes. So we can find that here and there. But I think it's a valuable lesson for us to stay with this play, with this point that, yeah, some lilas may be a little bit mysterious and difficult to understand. Also, some acharyas will say, okay, they left in a very quote unquote ordinary way, like a veil. Like people without vision will see that as ordinary, and people with deep vision will see beyond the ordinariness. Like a way of closing the curtain in a mysterious way, but those who understand will understand. Remember that many times the realm of Lila and the loving interactions between Bhagavan and their devotees is, and his devotees are crooked in the good sense of the term, happen indirectly, are not overtly in a clear way that we think it should be. So that invites us to read in between the lines. No? And again, we could go in detail to many of the commentaries that, for example, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur writes to that section in the Bhagavatam, but to be honest, we don't have time now, but if you will, I could direct whomever would like you to that section, and I can even share the files if you want. There are many, many interesting further insights and perspectives he's adding. But at the end of the day, his conclusion is, of course, Bhagavan is beyond beyond a hunter and an arrow in the foot sole, right? It sounds pretty simplistic, right? Oh, he died with a foot sole and an arrow. It's like, yeah, why not? And he's totally beyond that. No, it sounds pretty ordinary, but again, as if you pay a very external look to how the many of the lilas on earth unfolded, they could also feel pretty ordinary. And we could say, why Krishna didn't do this more fancy thing here? When Yashoda was tying him, why he didn't liberate himself from the rope and transcended everything? It would have been more mystical. But there is a sweetness in that. So in the same way, there is a sweetness in their living in a pretty ordinary way. And at the same time, realizing that these are all extraordinary people, living their lila in a curtain of ordinariness, so to say, to set the tone. No? Lila on earth may look ordinary, but we are invited to pay more close attention to that. So those will be a few thoughts in connection to that. Again, as much as I can share with the time we have today. But if it's required for more, please let me know some other day that I will have more time. We'll happily share, or I can share some of those sections from the Bhagavatam as well. Yeah. I hope that helps, Katie, somehow.
Yes, thank you, Maharaj. That was helpful.
Okay, thank you. So we'll skip this breakout room as we always keep one or two, and we'll go to the last offering questions exploration today by Silpa Karini before we put our sharing to rest today. So you can unmute yourself. Silpa Karini, welcome.
Yeah, Hare Krishna Maharaj. Actually, I just quickly wanted to say thank you. I'm really glad that I discovered that Zoom thingy. I cannot spell the name. And I was listening to that I discovered here everyone, the Zoom meeting every
These
week.
gatherings,
The what?
these meetings we are having every week.
Yeah,
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I'm very happy about that. And also, I was listening when you were in Switzerland with Krishna Chandra about Gaura Gadadhar. That was really, it's kind of a, I would say a lifesaver. It's, I'm here alone in the Black Forest. And it's like I integrated it in my sadhana, so to speak. And it's really, I'm really grateful for that. And I'm really, really happy. And that and at the same time, I also become fearful that something maybe happens and that this is not anymore the case, right? That I don't have access to that anymore or whatever. So it's really a life changer. That's all.
Thank you.
See.
Okay, so there was no question, right? You want to express appreciation today. Okay, thank you very much for that. Thank you very much for that. And well, we are happy you have discovered us for this gathering, and we are happy we have discovered you as well. It's always reciprocal. It's always a mutual discovery. And I will say, hopefully there is no need to fear that this will be over. Let's not let that feeling cripple in, like, what if the worst thing possible could happen at any moment? Because if we allow that too much, we are missing what's already taking place, right? So as long as you keep paying your internet bill monthly and you can connect to Zoom, you will be able to join us. And if you cannot pay the bill, let us know. We will do some collection, and you can continue joining from the forest somehow or other. So thank you for your words. And going back, since there was no actual question, which is totally fine. There's space for everything here. But I'm reading that also back to Rasa regarding Katie's question. And probably we can conclude with one last breakout room going back to Katie's question, since I was planning to do one more breakout room. She's saying that this Leela also eliminated the possibility of saying that these were right and these were wrong, saying that these people are divine and these others are ordinary. So yeah, that's another very beautiful insight, right? Like, basically they killed each other. So nobody could kill them in one sense, because they are beyond all this killing thing. So they just kill each other equally, and they all left together. Again, I know on the outside it may feel a little gore, a little bit like gruesome, you say. Remember, they were Kshatriyas, so it was happening all in the context of Kshatriya-like dynamics with some intoxication in between. But again, there are very interesting commentaries by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in making like parallels with, okay, the intoxication, that they were drinking some wine and then start to fight with one another. But the intoxication, you ultimately connected to divine love, because they are eternal associates. And in that intoxication, they were carried to act in that particular way to bring the Leela to a close. So, and again, it sounds, as Rasangi mentioned, maybe pointing to imperfection at all levels. It looks externally very imperfect, very, that those are not eternal associates. Now, how will they behave like that? So again, it's like a test to our vision, right? Like to our ideas of perfection, going back to that topic, to our ideas of how things should flawlessly unfold, and to leave room for something happening in ways we did not expect, which look pretty ordinary, and which still remain untouched by mundane influences altogether. You know? And again, to relate to that back to our own lives. Because sometimes also making it a little bit more personal or realistic for us, relatable. Sometimes we may even see some examples, life examples of devotees or practitioners who live a sincere spiritual life, but somehow the end of their life is not as glorious as we think it should be. Again, in external terms, no? Like for example, sometimes I hear people say, "Oh, well, Prabhupada left in Vrindavan. That was glorious," and indeed it was. But if he would have left in Panama or in Congo or Venezuela, it would have been equally glorious, right? It's not that, oh, he needs to live in the dam for the passing to be perfect. And that's our own projection of what I think it has to be in this. If he will have left in Paris or London or Russia, I mean, he will have gone to the exact same place he went by living in Vrindavan, because he was already living in Vrindavan, as we all know. So my point with this is that sometimes some devotees may leave their bodies in situations externally which may not seem the most ideal in our estimation. No? Sometimes we think, oh, the ideal will be or in Vrindavan or in their home with 108 devotees doing 108 hours of kirtan, everything 108. And some tulsi leaf here and this here, and like checking all the boxes of perfection. And maybe they pass in the hospital in with dementia and some other conditions that you may call even embarrassing, no? Like a little bit strange on the psychophysical dimension. And it may not sound like, oh, that was not ideal. And even that can take to faith crisis, like why Krishna is allowing this, why Krishna is not protecting the devotee, I'm not arranging. But who say that that's not perfect? Who say that Krishna is not present there? Who says that that devotee is not like transitioning smoothly to that ideal place that devotee wanted? And again, externally, the outer form of that transition may seem bewildering to us. But that's just us being bewildered by the packaging of the situation. But besides the packaging, there's so much more going on. So I'm giving just a more ex relatable maybe example that somehow speaks about the same of your question, Katie, regarding Krishna, his eternal associates, and by extension, you can apply that to the life of bhaktas and so on. And again, some of the things need not be in certain way for them to be ideal or perfect, because there are many ways for them to be perfect. No? It's not like this is the only perfect way or this is the best way. As long as as long as the heart is in the particular place, the heart is leading the way. Like once someone served. Maybe you know the story, Srila Siddha Maharaj will tell it. Someone served Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur a plate of prasad with different preparations. And they will ask him, "Oh, Guru Maharaj," he was tasting, sorry, all the preparations. And someone asks at the end, "Oh, Guru Maharaj, which was your favorite?" And he replies saying, "Oh, everything is better than everything." He say, right? That's a very interesting answer, right? He didn't say, "Oh, this is best, this comes second, this is third, and this is the final one." He said, "Everything is better than everything," because he said, "I'm dealing with the absolute, with prasad, with the grace of Bhagavan in the form of I cannot put hierarchies here." So in the same way, going back to our topic, how a particular person transitions to their next life, whether it is God Himself, an associate, us, anyone. If they are properly internally situated, it can take endless different forms, and each one of them is better than each one of them, so to say. So we should not be too, how to say, preoccupied or concerned about the external shape it took, but what's going on the inside. Because in some other cases, you can have a very fancy outer arrangement, but internally, we are not that fancy, so to say. So that's what Krishna says in the Gita, as I say, 8:6. Whatever he uses the word bhava to refer, bhava means inner state, but also bhava means a particular form of existence. Subjam baptismaram bhavam tyajantyante kalevaram tam tame vaiti kauntiya satatat bhava bhavitaha. So whatever bhava you're in, that takes you to a particular bhava. Whatever state, inner state of consciousness you're in, that takes you to a particular corresponding situation in existence. So that's our focus. And no matter what outer form it takes, some great Vaishnavas have died in an accident. Some Vaishnavas have died naturally, without sickness, with sickness, with all varieties of sickness, have died killed. And not only Vaishnavas, saintly people from all sorts. So in earthquakes, I mean, you name it. So, but in one sense, that's not the end of the story. That does not actually define the trajectory, the inner trajectory of that Atma. So, and I know it's not easy for us because we do not see what happens beyond that final quote unquote moment. We just stay with that final image. Well, and it sounds like, wow, that was it. They kill each other intoxicated, or an arrow on the footsole, or an earthquake, or an accident. But we have to remind ourselves, no, that's just one frame of the whole movie. No? The journey continues to go on in so many brilliant ways. So, yeah. Yeah, this is one of many ways to think we are not this body. In other words, we are not that particular frame of the movie that only exists for a particular moment. Because to say we are not this body means also we are not something that is here for a moment, was not here before, won't be here after, at least not in this particular same form. So we shouldn't be like overtly stuck with a particular expression of something that keeps moving. So in the same way with Leelas of disappearance or whatever, right? Okay, let's go to one final breakout room with that added footnote. A little longest footnote in history of literature, probably. Sorry for that. So one last breakout room to continue sharing about some of the themes together related to this last question. And yeah, see you in a few minutes for our farewell for today. Hey, welcome back. Hoping you had a nice sharing as well. And with that, we'll put our session to rest today. So we have to arrange here for our guests, upcoming guests, and first meeting in the UK retreat. But we look forward to meeting you next week. Next Saturday will be at the same timing as today, just for you to remember. We'll share a notification more close to the day. But since we will still be in the UK retreat by that time, we'll share that. And then the other Saturday, I'll be already back in the US, so we'll go back to our normal, whatever is normal time. So thanks so much to all of you for your presence. Looking forward to sharing together again. Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol.